Contact Patel Law for a free consultation to discuss your Social Security disability case. Patel Law is located at 108 West University Avenue in Urbana with offices in Danville and Decatur. For more information, visit patellawteam.com or call 217-384-1111. And now stay tuned for Disability Beat.
My name is Deb Frank Finan from the city of Champaign. You're listening to Disability Beat on WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM, community radio for East Central Illinois.
This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for an interview with Illinois State Senator Daniel Biss of Evanston discussing the state's recent commitment to employment-first legislation for people with developmental disabilities. But first, disability news for the week of July 25, 2016 from Disability Scoop and Inclusion Daily Express. The nation's largest health insurer says it will soon include coverage of applied behavior analysis in every group plan it offers. United Healthcare said that starting next year, every small and large group plan it sells across the country will feature coverage of the autism therapy. Beginning on or after January 1, 2017, they will be extending ABA benefit coverage to new and renewing fully insured small and large group plans in the few remaining states that do not mandate ABA coverage. Individual plans are not yet included in this change. In addition, ABA benefits will be part of all self-funded plans administered by United Healthcare unless companies explicitly choose to opt out, the insurer indicated. Self-funded plans are used by many large employers like Walmart and Starbucks and are not subject to the same rules as typical health insurance policies, but companies often follow the recommendations of health insurers who manage their plans to determine coverage. The move to include ABA in policies nationwide comes as the vast majority of states, 44 total, mandate such coverage, a fact acknowledged by United Healthcare in its announcement. Lori Unum, Vice President of State Government Affairs at Autism Speaks, called the development absolutely huge for autism families and said she hopes other insurers will follow suit. Said Unum, who has been instrumental in pushing for state mandates, quote, "Never before has an insurance provider stepped up to the plate and decided to make this a standard benefit," end quote. Based on a conservative estimate of the number of people currently covered by United Healthcare's large group plans in states without an existing ABA mandate, Unab said she expects that at least 250,000 people could be impacted by the insurer's decision. In a groundbreaking decision, the Minnesota Human Rights Department found that a large nonprofit likely violated a worker's civil rights when it denied him a promotion because he received services for a cognitive disability. State Human Rights Commissioner Kevin Lindsay found probable cause that Opportunity Partners, one of Minnesota's largest employers of people with disabilities, discriminated against Bradford Teslow, age 59, of St. Paul, Minnesota, who received state-funded job support services at the Bloomington Assembly Plant, where he packages parts for portable refrigeration units. Although Opportunity Partners disputes the decision, the agency said it is changing its hiring practices to allow recipients of disability services to be considered for regular work at the nonprofit. Increasingly, Medicaid dollars are going toward community-based services as opposed to institutional care, but some states are moving in that direction more rapidly than others. Of the $152 billion spent on long-term care services across the country during the 2014 fiscal year, 53% was directed to community-based services, according to a new report produced for the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. That's an increase over the 51% seen in fiscal year 2013, which marked the first year that the majority of Medicaid long-term care dollars went to community-based services. Such funding has ticked up 1 to 3% nearly every year since 1995, the report indicates. Funding for community-based services was lowest in Mississippi, representing just 27.2% of that state's Medicaid long-term care allocation, and highest in Oregon, where it accounted for 79.2%, the report found. Illinois is also in the bottom, ranking 35th out of 50 states. The U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights said this month that it determined a Virginia school district retaliated against a parent who was advocating for her daughter who was receiving special education services at one of their schools. According to OCR's findings, the district contacted the parent's employer, a contractor working for the school district, and questioned if she was a good fit at her job within the school. This happened after meetings and communications with the parent that school staff described as very uncomfortable and aggressive, according to OCR. OCR also said the contractor was informed by the district that it did not want her, the parent, to continue working at the school. The resolution agreement says the school district must compensate the parent for all expenses she incurred as a result of the school's actions. The parent told OCR that she incurred almost $23,000 in damages. And finally, the North Miami, Florida police officer who shot an unarmed black mental health worker caring for a client actually took aim at the man with autism next to him but missed, the head of the police union said on Thursday. It was a stunning admission from the police officer and from John Rivera, who heads up Miami-Dade's Police Benevolent Association. But it was one meant to calm the fears of a nation besieged with cell phone videos of police shooting and sometimes killing unarmed black men. In this case, Rivera said the officers ended up wounding the man he tried to save. On Monday, the police officer shot Charles Kinsey, age 47, after police said mistakenly believing that Kinsey was going to be killed by the 23-year-old man with autism playing with a toy truck who was sitting on the ground next to him. Rivera said the officer feared the man with autism had a weapon. Retired firearms expert Robert Holscher, who spent 50 years with the Miami-Dade Police Department, said it's hard to perceive how that situation was misjudged. Holscher said, quote, "I wish there was something positive I could say. You arrive on scene and a guy's playing with a toy truck. Why do you bring out the assault rifle? You can't get enough training when you're dealing with lethal force. This is as bad a situation as I've ever seen. It's a good thing he was obviously a lousy marksman." End quote. And that's the news for this week.
Baby, baby, oops, I did it again. I play with your heart, got lost in the game. Ooh, baby, baby, oops, you think I'm in love, that I sent from above. I'm not that innocent. I'm dreaming away, wishing that heroes truly exist. I cry watching the...
You are listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, and I'm joined today, very excited to have on the phone, Senator Daniel Biss of Evanston, who is one of the instrumental people in implementing what is really still new legislation regarding employment for individuals with developmental disabilities. Welcome to the program, Senator.
Thank you so much for having me, Vicki.
So why don't you introduce yourself to the listeners a little bit? You're from Evanston. You're not from Central Illinois, but you have been an instrumental person in this new legislation, relatively new legislation. So why don't you introduce yourself first and then talk about your involvement with Employment First?
Well, thanks very much. As you said, I'm Daniel Biss. I live in Evanston, which is the suburb just north of Chicago. I represent 11 suburbs of Chicago in the Illinois Senate. I've been in the legislature. This is now my sixth year. And, you know, you're generous in calling this recent. To be honest, I think there's some justified impatience one might have because this it's not actually quite so recent anymore, but the bill was House Bill 2591. It went into effect on July 16th of 2013. It was sponsored in the House by Representative Esther Golar, who was a really wonderful woman and tragically passed away, no longer with us, but I had the honor of being the Senate sponsor. And it really did a few very simple things. First of all, it mandated coordination between state agencies so that they would be collaborating to ensure that they were working to fund competitive and integrated employment of individuals with disabilities, as well as to track data and make sure that we're really keeping track of what actually is happening, not just what is an abstract theory. And then the second part was that there was an existing task force called, I believe, the Economic Opportunity for Persons with Disabilities Task Force that had been created under a previously existing law, and the goal was for that task force to establish measurable goals and objectives for truly equal, integrated, fair employment opportunities for individuals with disabilities, and that progress has been going on, but it's been slow, and I think it's important for us to keep advocating for that to really come to be. The purpose of passing this law wasn't just to pass the law so we could say we passed the law. The purpose was to really make sure that the work was actually done to change Illinois practices and policies so that individuals with disabilities had opportunities to have really, truly integrated, fair employment and opportunities where they would be paid a fair wage as well. And I think you would unfortunately probably agree that as much as there's been some progress, we're really not where we need to be in that area yet.
Yes, I would absolutely agree. But you know, I know that money is a barrier. Anything that comes through Springfield is, you know, hampered by the lack of available money. But other than money, what are the barriers that we're dealing with as a state?
You know, I think it's time and attention. This was something that was enacted into law under Governor Quinn, and his administration was interested in trying to promote the full implementation of this act. And then Governor Rauner came in, and he was new and had a lot of new people. And, you know, I was actually quite hard on the administration in some hearings we had, about 6 months ago. And their response was, look, we're new, we're doing our best, and we're enthusiastic about participating in the implementation of this, but you need to give us some time to really get all the way there. And I think that was actually a really fair point. And the state government is one where there's just a tremendous number of really terrifying challenges that are taking up everybody's time. And this kind of action, in addition to requiring some money, just requires attention and focus and coordination. You've got to get everybody in different agencies who are all dealing with a tremendous number of different and very serious problems to work together and coordinate and take on a problem that is, as a matter of civil and human rights, absolutely crucial, but as a matter of politics, kind of outside of the core issues that we have been spending the bulk of our attention on. And as the community of advocates for individuals with disabilities is all too painfully aware, it's been easy for the Illinois governmental system to focus on the more kind of political hot button issues instead of these essential civil rights issues.
Absolutely. But as the mom of an adult woman with a developmental disability who does have a job, you know, I realize how fortunate she is and how there are people out there who are being served in a way that allows them to work just like anybody else. But there are so many concerns with, you know, we have such a large number of sheltered workshops in the state.
Yeah.
I mean, how do we get around that?
Well, I think it's a cultural thing. I think there was a time when, frankly, sheltered workshops were viewed as a state-of-the-art positive thing, and we just can't accept that. We can't allow people to live in that world anymore, and that's part of why we is fully competitive and integrated employment of persons with disabilities, period. That's what we're for. Anything else is simply not in keeping with our vision of what the civil rights of individuals with disabilities are. And, you know, I don't think that that's an education process that has been completed. I think there's a lot of people who would think, well, you know, sure, we should give individuals with disabilities an opportunity, but we can't really have it be fully competitive. It can't really be integrated with other people. It must be good enough to have a kind of out of sight, out of mind shelter workshop situation. And those of us who have really thought this through and realized that that's just not acceptable have to be a part of educating our fellow citizens that, you know, what might have seemed like a noble, progressive way of handling things 30 years ago is actually now something that we realize to be simply incomplete justice and therefore a lack of justice.
Right. So the benefits are obvious from my perspective, that people can earn money, they make a contribution to their community. How would the state itself benefit by implementing employment first?
I was really struck as I was waiting to come on, as you were talking about in your reading of the disability news, you were talking about statistics about the shift toward home care as opposed to institutional care in the long-term care setting. And this is something that we talk about when it's in the context of elder care, when it's in the context of mental health care, when it's in the context of care for individuals with developmental disabilities. And it should be not just about care, but it should be about public policy. We don't say, hey, it's better to provide home care for older adults rather than institutional nursing home care when possible for some technical reason. We say that because it is better for all of society if everybody in society is included in their community. It is better for all of society if we say all the 13 million people who live in Illinois are part of the same culture, the same community, and we want to live together, work together, play together, and interact together. And I think this notion that segregation is better has just never worked. Certainly, it's a grotesque injustice for the individuals being segregated. That's first and foremost. But for everybody else, it's just never worked to create as thriving and vibrant a society as we can. We're always all better off if we build structures that put us together. And this is just one more component of that very, very, very big picture philosophical goal that I think we have been always incomplete in achieving in America, but we're always at our best when we move toward it. And we're not, again, not just at our best on an altruistic level, but we make our own society as close to as good as it can be when we include everybody fully and in a truly integrated way.
Very well said. I wonder, though, I mean, I hear you talk about, you know, collaboration between agencies and, you know, measuring progress. And those are both very important things. And maybe this isn't a fair question to ask of you, but what specifically are the expectations of Illinois when it comes to change at the agency level? Is there going to be less funding for sheltered workshops and incentives for providers who are providing jobs for individuals? How is that looking right now?
Yeah, so that's not an unfair question. That's the exact right question for you to be asking. None of that is in this law that we passed back in 2013, I'll be the first to admit. That's all the next set of steps, and those are steps that we have to take. And I think that you and I can probably sit here and agree that 50 years from now, that will all have happened.
I sure hope so.
Our question, my question, my challenge as a policymaker is what do I do today so that we don't have to wait 50 years? And it's not going to happen entirely tomorrow, but that transition needs to happen much faster than it's happening now. And so what incentives can we put in place? What explicit, hard, numerical goals can we put into the law that would really accelerate that transition? And fundamentally, normalize what you and I both know is entirely normal, which is the fully integrated employment of individuals with disabilities.
And I agree with that as well. I just wonder, though, if it's not going to take a lawsuit to make it happen, because it seems like nothing in Illinois changes without lawsuits. I mean, look at Ligas and Williams and Colbert and all of those class action suits that have begun moving the system, at least for housing for people with developmental disabilities. Now, you know, people want jobs, and how are those going to happen if we can't? And I hate, it seems like a negative view, but to have to force Illinois to do those things. And it's happened in Oregon. It's happened in, I think, Rhode Island, that, you know, sheltered workshops have been outlawed over a period of years. So that transition has been forced.
Exactly. Exactly. Look, the history of Illinois is ugly and clear, and nobody who knows that history should say, don't worry about lawsuits, they won't be necessary this time. I think we have to acknowledge that that's an important tool. It's been the most effective tool historically to win these kinds of victories. I would say that my job is to try to enact good policies on the state level so as to avoid the need for a lawsuit. And if I can be successful, then so much the better. And if I can't, then we have to use the courts as a backstop. But, you know, I get up every morning and try to do the job that I can so that Illinois doesn't get dragged kicking and screaming to gradually do the right thing 20 years too late, but hopefully we can start doing the right thing because we know it's right, and do it of our own volition, based upon conviction, not obligation.
And educating the public, I think, is an important piece of that, too.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. And, you know, I always tell individuals, tell people in the community that of individuals with disabilities and their families and supporters that you know, when I run for office and I go door to door in my neighborhood, every single block there's a family who is touched by this question, whether it's someone who lives in the house or a close friend or close family member. There's someone on each block who understands the human dignity and civil rights consequences of getting this issue right or wrong, and understands what Illinois has been doing wrong. But by the same token, every other house on that block, people don't really mention the issue. And so what we need to do when it comes to education is to help all Illinois residents, whether or not they're the parent of a person with a disability, to understand that this is a civil rights issue, and as a civil rights issue, we all should feel that it affects all of us. We all have an obligation, if we are not personally the victim of the injustice, to be allies of those who are. And once more people who are not personally the victims of the injustice nonetheless pick up that banner and start acting as allies, I think we'll see more rapid action. And that's something that you can only achieve with education.
Speaking of allies, who are your allies in the Senate who are the go-to people for this legislation? Hopefully it's more than just you.
You know, it is. It is. I am the chairman of the Human Services Committee in the Senate, and I would say that members of our committee have been very responsive to this issue. We had a really robust hearing on it, like I said, about 6 months ago. And you know, I remember Senator Staines and Senator Morrison and Senator Hunter were all there, and they were very engaged and committed to get this right. I believe Senator Bush was there also, and she also was speaking passionately about this issue. So I'm not the only one, and, you know, I think that's an important thing. I sit on the Senate floor next to Senator Tom Cullerton from DuPage County, and he talks with me passionately almost every day, certainly every week, about his concerns about the puns list and the way we're handling that. And, you know, there is powerful advocacy that's happened around this issue, and it has awoken many of us, and that's really a tribute to the families who do that advocacy. We just need to all stand together and keep on working on that and pushing yet harder.
So for those family members and professionals out there who are listening to this program and listening to you talk about this issue today, what is something that they can do to help Illinois move forward with Employment First?
I would say call your legislators, or write your legislators, and then write the governor, and simply lay out why this is such an important issue, and say that you're aware that Illinois has a policy that was enacted in 2013, and you applaud Illinois for that, but you want to see it implemented, and you want to see it implemented robustly and quickly. I will be honest with you, I don't think most legislators have, you know, been hearing from people about this issue, and I think when you start to generate letters and calls into people's offices, that that gets noticed, and it can really make a difference.
Some people say to me, well, you know, the disability community, they don't have money like other groups out there. Does that really make a difference?
Look, I would be lying if I said it didn't matter. It would be silly, right? The groups that have money choose to spend it on politics, and they're probably doing that for a reason. But what I will say, and this is crucial, is it's not the only thing that matters. Aggressive advocacy, building strong relationships with the legislators in question, frankly, being on the right side of the issue and pushing hard, these things matter. You know, when I was first elected, I hadn't, you know, finished cleaning up at the end of my victory party before I got a call from a few very, very active mothers of adult children with disabilities in my district, and they said, Daniel, we want to meet with you now. Not after you're sworn in, not when the budget's about to pass, now.
I think I know those mothers.
I'll bet you do. And they have been advisors to me every step of the way on these issues. And that started, you know, the minute I was elected, and it's gone on until today. And I can assure you that if a major issue around these questions were to come up in the legislature tomorrow morning, I would get a call before noon from some of those moms, and they would be, you know, giving me advice and sharing their thoughts. And I can assure you, I take their opinions incredibly seriously. And well, that's because they've proven themselves to be not just passionate, but knowledgeable and thoughtful and experts on the issues. And if I didn't take advantage of that expertise to improve the job I do, I'd be nuts.
Yeah, well,
that
thank
kind
you.
Of thing really matters.
Thank you for what you do. Thank you for your expertise and your thoughts on this particular issue. It's all near and dear to our hearts, and I thank you for joining me on the program today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed the discussion, and I'm happy to talk anytime and help you any way I can.
Thanks very much, Senator Daniel Biss of the Illinois Senate. This and other episodes of Disability Beat are podcast on our website at www.disabilitybeat.com, or go to Facebook and look for Disability Beat Radio. Please send your comments and show ideas for guests or topics to disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Hope you have a great week. Pushing me around.